This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucet Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Presenteeism is an affliction of American culture. That's the term for showing up at work, even when you're sick and possibly infectious. But what if the person who is coughing and sneezing and pushing through a fever is your physician? A study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association Pediatrics found that a disturbing amount of healthcare workers go to work when they are sick. Jeff Stark is an infection control officer at Texas Children's Hospital. He wrote a commentary called When the Healthcare Worker is Sick that accompanied the study when it was published. Jeff Stark, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you very much.
So first, a little on the study. Where did it take place?
The study took place at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and it was a study of faculty or senior physicians and advanced care providers, over 500 of them, asking them questions whether or not they worked when they were sick, and if so, why?
Well, so what were the findings?
Well, 80% of the folks that answered said that they, in fact, had worked when they were sick with a potentially infectious illness. To be perfectly honest with you, when I talk to people, I say 80% said yes, and 20% were probably lying, because I don't think I know a physician that hasn't gone to work when he or she was ill. And the reasons were interesting. A lot of them had to do with dedication. Dedication to the patients, dedication to their colleagues, and so forth. But some of them were more disturbing. One of them was the inability to find someone else to fill in for them, and the feeling that they, in fact, were responsible for finding someone to work for them. You know, so again, the person who's sick has to go out and find the person who's going to cover. And even more disturbing to many of us is physicians now are being graded on their productivity, how many patients we're seeing, how much money we're generating. And a lot of the respondents said that they came to work because they couldn't afford to lose the productivity, which is very disturbing.
Okay, so some of those sound like procedural, workplace-based, and some sound personal. What do you think it is about the culture of healthcare workers in particular that makes this seem personal?
Well, the good side of things is I think people are really incredibly dedicated, and they're dedicated to the patients, they're dedicated to the jobs and the institutions, and this sort of overwhelming feeling of not wanting to let people down. This goes back a long, long time. When I was in training 30 years ago, I mean, people would literally be working while they were receiving IVs because they were dehydrated. You call it macho culture. Physicians who took off when they were sick were sometimes even considered slackers. You know, it's kind of similar to a football player sort of playing through an injury or playing through pain. We sort of expect ourselves to do exactly the same thing. From the institution point of view, the institutions still kind of think of doctors as individual practitioners and haven't really set up systems to allow for the fact that sometimes the physician won't be able to be there because they're sick or have something else come up.
Well, as you point out, this goes counter to the guiding principle for all healthcare workers that they first do no harm. What are the risks here?
Well, minimal colds are probably not that big a deal. In fact, by the time people are suffering real cold symptoms, probably they're not even as infectious as they were a few days earlier, although they are potentially infectious. Particularly worrisome, though, are things like the flu. You know, we know, for instance, that flu shots are not 100%. In fact, this past year, they were only 19% effective. And so there are contagious diseases physicians can have that they can pass on to other folks. If a person's in the hospital and they're fairly healthy and they're for sort of an acute problem, that's one thing. But we have an awful lot of people in hospitals now whose immune systems are not functioning well. And if they get what to you and me might be a simple cold, it can literally be deadly to them. So the risk of even simple infections can be quite great for certain patients.
Well, you teach at Baylor. You're also at Children's Hospital. You're an example of a healthcare worker I wonder if you've ever been that physician who was feeling a little bit ill but continued to press on and go to work.
Oh, of course I have. Yes, absolutely I have. In fact, when I give lectures to physicians in other groups, I have several slides. The title of the slides are Working When You're Sick. And it's kind of an acknowledgement that people are going to work when they're sick, but there are some things you can do to minimize the risk. Things as simple as good hand hygiene, since most of these infections are actually spread on the hands and not through the air, sometimes wearing masks, and then making sure you don't go see vulnerable patients. And to be honest, if I were counseling a family or if my child were in the hospital, particularly if my child were sick and vulnerable to catching infections, if someone came in the room and they were obviously ill, I would ask them to leave and say, I'm sorry, I really don't want you around my child. And I think that's a perfectly valid thing for patients and families to do.
So just talk, what needs to happen in order for this culture to change?
Well, I think one the major thing that needs to happen is that institutions need to change, especially in children's hospitals now. In most all over the country, the physicians actually work for the hospital. And so the hospitals need to develop systems that have much more of a team approach. And we need to morph more toward, you know, it's not just my service and my patients, but it's our team's service and team's patients, and allow for this and cover for each other and have systems whereby people don't feel so responsible, not only just for being there, but also for finding whoever else can take care of their patients. So I think hospitals have some responsibility here. I think practices have some responsibility here. And, of course, so do individuals.
Well, Jeff Stark, thank you for speaking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Jeff Stark, he's an infection control officer at Texas Children's Hospital and professor at Baylor College of Medicine. He wrote the commentary, When the Healthcare Worker is Sick, that was published in JAMA Pediatrics. You'll find a link to read it at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Watching movies, making dinner, ordering a book, finding a date, all can be done online. Add a visit to the doctor to the virtual lifestyle mix. Telemedicine has been around for years, mostly to connect remote or rural patients with healthcare workers and specialists. It is now accessible to anyone with a smartphone, tablet, or computer. Abby Goodenough is a healthcare reporter for the New York Times who recently wrote about the increasing use of telemedicine for house calls. And Abby, welcome back to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So why would someone consult a doctor online?
Well, convenience is the number one reason. A lot of people, you know, they kind of dread going to the doctor. They dread making an appointment, maybe being told that they can't come in for a day or two. They dread even more the idea of going to an urgent care clinic or worse, an emergency room and waiting 45 minutes or an hour or 3 hours to get the care they need. So people can sit right in their homes and use Skype or a version, something like Skype, that they're already really familiar with to do this. And it's just easy and pretty straightforward and simple.
I've seen examples of telemetry in very remote places. You know, they'd have tools for reading a heart rate or
right.
a temperature. How can they do that on a regular smartphone or computer?
Well, that's getting further than down the road than we are really already. The thing that I wrote about that's really taking off in terms of direct-to-consumer telemedicine, as they call it, is the virtual urgent care, which is really just seeing doctors online for really basic things like sore throat or a virus or a cold. I think they're working on things now that will help you do more diagnostic stuff, like take the place of a stethoscope or a blood pressure cuff or something and be able to transfer that data online from your home or your workplace or wherever, but for the most part, we're not there yet.
You mentioned the convenience of telemedicine. Who is going to benefit most from this kind of medicine?
Well, I think it's going to continue to benefit the people who telemedicine has always benefited to an extent, which is people who have trouble accessing doctors, especially if you live in a more rural or remote location. So it's going to continue to help those people, and it's also just going to help the harried. It's going to help moms who are worried about their kids in the middle of the night, since this is like a 24/7 operation a lot of the time. It's going to help busy working people who don't want to take time from work to go to see the doctor or to an urgent care clinic. It's going to help people who just want to save time in their day and people who are busy, or at least I think that's how the companies are looking at it.
Who are some of the companies who are involved?
Well, I wrote about how health and hospital systems are increasingly getting involved themselves because they see competition from not just from telemedicine companies, but from the Minute Clinics of the world, the retail drugstore type clinic that are also providing a more convenient kind of doctor's appointment. But so some of the companies are Doctor on Demand, Teladoc, American Well. These companies, or many of them, have their own apps that you can download and go through a process to sign up and see one of their doctors directly. But increasingly, a lot of them are also working with health and hospital systems as sort of a third-party provider. So it will look like the hospital system that you're getting your doctor's appointment from online, but they're really using doctors and a technology platform of this third-party company.
How does the cost compare to a visit to urgent care or primary care, for that matter?
It's significantly cheaper than a primary care doctor appointment, which I believe is in the several hundred dollar range. Most of these urgent care visits are somewhere between $40 and $50, maybe a little more.
Are these kind of telemedicine consultations covered by insurance?
Increasingly, they are covered by insurance. You know, a lot of the big insurers are now getting into this and deciding they want to offer this as a benefit or cover it as a benefit. United Healthcare is jumping in and going to be covering it for most of their members. And that's like one of the largest insurance companies in the country, if not the largest, by the end of next year. Aetna has also really jumped into it. A lot of workplaces, like if you have an employer-sponsored health insurance plan, they will also cover it as a benefit at this point, and more jumping in. So I think it is more likely moving forward that more of us will have this as a covered benefit, but at this point, there's still a lot of us who would have to pay for it out of pocket.
And Medicare will not cover it, I understand from your article.
Medicare will not cover it for the most part. I think there's a couple of exceptions, maybe with Medicare Advantage plans, but for the most part, Medicare has not jumped in wholeheartedly to telemedicine, and particularly to direct-to-consumer type of telemedicine. There are some reports or estimates that suggest that it's just going to add to costs, that using this type of telemedicine is going to add to overall healthcare costs, not actually reduce it. And one of the questions is whether people are going to use it in addition to going to the doctor, or perhaps use it instead of not doing anything at all, in which case it certainly would increase costs, at least some. But I think there's increasingly, you know, pressure on Medicare to start experimenting more with offering this sort of thing because there is increasing demand for it and people are saying it just makes sense.
We're speaking with Abby Goodenough. She's a healthcare reporter for the New York Times. She recently wrote about accessing healthcare consultations online via Skype or FaceTime or similar kind of platforms. How do doctors seem to feel about it? I mean, it would be competition for them, I would imagine.
Right. I think for every doctor you ask, you're going to get a different opinion. I mean, certainly there's many, many doctors who are now working part-time or full-time or on contract for these companies who are totally buying into it. There's a lot of other doctors, more old-school doctors in particular, who think it's bad medicine, basically, who think it's really impossible and dangerous to try to diagnose any sort of ailment over the internet and by video. They want to lay hands on the patient. They want to look closely at the patient's eyes and ears and throat and feel the pulse, all the things that you can't do if you're staring at somebody, no matter how close, via video.
Yeah, I wonder about accuracy and malpractice in these kind of cases as well.
Right. All of these companies, for the most part, say they haven't had any malpractice cases at this point, and they say it's because partly because they're extra careful. They err on the side of caution so much, they say. They're making sure that they're not trying to diagnose or treat something that's not appropriate to be treated online. But it'll be interesting to see as this sort of visit proliferates if malpractice will become more of an issue.
Well, in many ways, this idea of you must see a doctor in order to get a prescription, and this is one way to get around that, you know, there are a couple of different sides to that. It's just part of the system. And the other is, you know, you just get a drug prescription for everything you get seen for. Does this kind of interaction with the doctor increase that probability that you're just getting an imprimatur stamp to get a prescription?
I think that's a big question, and one that doctors who are really hesitant about this type of service are batting around a lot and debating. I do know that there are certain types of prescriptions you can't get through these virtual care services, like for controlled substances. They're not going to prescribe those. There's a lot of concern that it's just a way to hand out antibiotic prescriptions and perhaps in inappropriate cases where people don't really need antibiotics. Although there was an interesting study recently that suggested that these virtual appointments don't dispense antibiotics at any higher rate than in person. But to get back to your basic question, I think that you do have to kind of give your medical history and go through a number of questions. And many of these doctors, from what I've seen, do ask some pretty thorough questions and take their time trying to figure out what's wrong with you. So I think that the good providers doing this and the careful and cautious providers are not just handing out prescriptions left and right.
Clearly, our adaptation of smartphone apps and conveniences online has been rapid. Do you think there's a real game changer for healthcare system in the U.S. in the coming years?
I mean, if you look at how much of a game changer this kind of technology has been for so many other facets of our life, for shopping and for, you know, making travel arrangements and all of the things that we now totally are accustomed to and want to do online, you would think that it could definitely be a big game changer for medicine. I think, of course, there are natural limitations and there are some really obvious things that you do in medicine that you're just not going to be able to do via video. But I do think in terms of people seeking convenience and wanting easier access to healthcare, this could be an interesting solution and potentially a game changer. As a harried person myself, I can certainly see the appeal.
Well, Abby Goodenough, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Yes, thanks for having me.
Abby Goodenough, she's a reporter for the New York Times, recently wrote the article Modern Doctors, House Calls, Skype Chat, and Fast Diagnosis. There's a link at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Well, as we just heard, it is small rural communities that would likely benefit from the high-tech service of telemedicine. Now to celebrating the more traditional charms of a picturesque New Hampshire town. E.E. Cummings is one of the most beloved modern American poets. Known for playing fast and loose with grammar and punctuation in his poems, few people realize that he was also an enthusiastic painter. Among his favorite subjects, the pastoral landscape surrounding Joy Farm in Silver Lake, New Hampshire, where Cummings and his third wife, the model Marion Morehouse, had a summer home, and where he died in 1962. Word of Mouth producer Molly Donahue visited Madison, New Hampshire, for a weekend celebration of Cummings' legacy at Silver Lake, and brings us this audio postcard.
He was not small case E.E. Cummings. He was just as much as anybody. He was, he had a first name that started with a capital letter and a last name that did the same. My name's Jesse Shackford III.
I'm Ruth Shackford.
My father and grandfather before him were caretakers for the Cummingses.
They were very private people. They never wanted us to give any information out to do with where they lived.
Well, it's Joy Farm. It's in Silver Lake, New Hampshire, and it was the childhood summer home of E.E. Cummings, and he actually died here. He collapsed in the house and was taken to the North Conway Hospital, where he was declared dead.
You know, I had mentioned it out to you. The one question I wondered was, how much was he integrated, Cummings, into?
Not at all.
Yeah, because he didn't go to the bean hole.
It was a stratified supper. All the locals knew of him was he stood.
That's right. That's right.
Staring down the railroad tracks.
We lived in a pretty downtown, with lots of floating Denny bells down.
I think that we all just considered him a poet from the city and treated him like one of us. Nobody expected anything special. They just treated him normal.
Parson says a sinner will perish in flame. Oh, Parson says a sinner will perish in the flame.
My favorite poem, well, of course, it's a poem about a church. I'm a little church, no great cathedral, far from the splendor and squalor of hurrying cities. I do not worry if briefer days grow briefest.
I am not sorry when the sun and the rain make April. My life is the life of the...
These poems that he wrote, he spent so much time constructing them. He knew Greek, he knew Roman, he knew all of these languages, and he was a wordsmith. He put things together which made sense to him. Not necessarily everybody else, but he worked very, very diligently. He wanted to be an artist. He wanted to be a painter. But he did a lot of poetry as well, and I think he was disappointed that his paintings didn't proliferate more, that he had to stay with the poetry to keep fed.
Alive, we're alive, always kissing a spring.
And that audio postcard came to us from Word of Mouth producer Molly Donahue.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Screaming hordes of teenage girls, meet and greets, late nights, long bus rides, and stops in 18 cities. Sounds like a boy band on the road. Yet this tour does not involve too much music, and there are no drugs or alcohol. That's forbidden. And at least once per show, a voice over the loudspeaker urges, "Now let's take some selfies." DigiTour, as it's called, features six performers, all under 20, some not even yet 15. The kids are on tour for one thing, being stars on social media. Not based on records sold, but for their number of followers on Instagram or Twitter. It is the new face of fame for the digital age. Ellen Cushing is a writer for BuzzFeed who tagged along on DigiTour, and she joins us now to talk about the teen social media sensation. Ellen, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. Hi.
So who gets to go on DigiTour?
Basically, it is a rotating cast of very, very famous teenagers. And when I say famous, I don't mean that you or I have heard of them. I mean that they have, you know, hundreds of thousands up to millions of followers on social media. You know, the biggest star of the tour that I went on has 3.5 million followers on Instagram, which is as many as Michelle Obama and Neil Patrick Harris combined.
Wowie. Well, what is a show like on the DigiTour?
So I liken it in my story to a middle school talent show, I believe, which sounds mean, I think, but is very accurate. You know, it's what you do when you have seven kids who are very charismatic but don't really have any super honed skills. So they do skits, they do games. Some of them do sing. Some of them cover other people's music. A couple of them have original songs. They kind of goof off in front of this screaming crowd of thousands of people.
Who is behind this? Who put together DigiTour?
So the company DigiTour was founded very recently. It was founded in 2010, I believe. Its CEO is 30, which makes a lot of sense because she really, really gets her audience. And she worked in music A&R before, and she sort of saw what was happening. This was roughly around the time Justin Bieber was blowing up. It was a little bit after. But at that point, it was clear that you could become famous by being famous on social media first. But nobody really knew how to do it. And this woman, Meredith Valiondo Rojas, kind of cracked the code.
Well, she calls her tour the Coachella for the YouTube generation and is really taking advantage of this new idea of fame. But how do they rise to internet fame?
You know, it sort of snowballs. A lot of them become famous because a photo that they took or a tweet they tweeted got retweeted by a slightly more famous social media celebrity. So there's this crew of probably a total of like 40 or 50 of these kids who support each other and tweeted each other. And I feel like I sound really old even trying to explain it because I don't fully understand it. And when you ask the kids, they don't fully understand it. But, you know, it is this sort of critical mass thing that happens when you have a certain number of followers. You just keep growing.
Well, you feel old. I feel like I have one foot in the grave. You rode the bus, Ellen. You were there with all the digi famous.
I was indeed.
So it also seems to me, you mentioned about 40 kids. I guess they take six or seven out at a time, but they're mostly all boys. What do you think is going on there?
So the DigiTour audience appears to be about 95% female. Meredith likens it to the boy band phenomenon a lot, which I think is pretty apt. These are teenage girls. You know, teenage girls are already sort of unabashed in their emotions. Having been one relatively recently, I think teenage girls are less ashamed to be enthusiastic about stuff than teenage boys are. I think teenage boys, when they kind of go through puberty, they sort of like revert inward, and their way of being cool is not showing enthusiasm. And I think teenage girls sort of do the opposite. So it's definitely a romantic boy band, like, sort of thing going on. We haven't mentioned this yet, but a big way DigiTour makes money isn't exactly show tickets. Show tickets are about $25. And, you know, at 1,000 to 3,000 kids a show, you're not making a huge amount of money, but they do a meet and greet, which is basically a receiving line kind of thing where 100 or 200 girls goes through this line, takes a photo with each of the boys, talks to them, like gets a hug, and for that it's about $160. Mm-hmm. So that's DigiTour's real cash cow, and that's the real appeal, is meeting these boys. And there's a very weirdly romantic burlesque of adult courtship performed by like 13-year-olds.
Well, it is not that different from, you know, people thought the Monkees were ridiculous in One Direction. It's hard to get the appeal if you are beyond 15 years old, I guess. But I'm trying to wrap my head around this kind of idea of talent. You know, we've watched the rise and discovery of plenty of new talents on TV shows where you're singing or designing clothes or having a good business idea. But what exactly is the talent being rewarded on DigiTour? It's just being internet famous?
So this was something that I kind of went through a transformation with myself on tour. At first, I was really, really skeptical, and I was like, these kids are just famous for being themselves. They're not doing anything. And at some point, I was talking to Meredith, DigiTour CEO, and she said that charisma is its own kind of talent, which is true. I couldn't do what these kids are doing. You know, they are up on stage every night for a couple hours, engaging with the fans. They put a ton of energy into their fan relationships. One of the things that's very new about stuff like DigiTour and is pretty different from traditional celebrity is there's a lot of fan interaction. So beyond the meet and greets, the fans are interacting with these kids on social media. They're tweeting at them, and sometimes the famous ones are tweeting back. So, you know, certainly they do not have, like, I didn't see any otherworldly bring down the house musical talent while I was watching DigiTour, but they definitely are doing something appealing.
We're speaking with Ellen Cushing from BuzzFeed, who wrote an article about the teen social media sensations on tour, which is called DigiTour. Basically, people phenomenally popular on Vine and Instagram and on Twitter who go on tour and appear in front of thousands of people for being internet famous. It was helpful for me to kind of see you turn around on that because I felt similarly cynical, I think. Are these kids able to be normal teens? I mean, do they go to high school? Do they have dreams and aspirations beyond social media fame, or is that enough?
They are absolutely not able to be normal teens. Most of them don't go to high school because they're on tour. You know, I was on tour for a few days, but they're on tour for weeks at a time. They don't go to high school. The more famous ones can't even go to a high school football game or a mall or an amusement park without being completely mobbed. Yeah. Most of them, like, buy their clothes online because they can't deal with going to the mall anymore. They're not living normal lives. You know, who knows what'll happen later. The youngest one was 14, which is really, really young. And he definitely doesn't know what he wants for his future. A lot of them want to stay in entertainment. I think many of them are kind of primed to go into hosting, like a Jimmy Fallon type existence or Ryan Seacrest. Some of them will probably change their minds at some point. I talked a lot to one of the kid, Jonah Marais, I talk to his mom a lot, and, you know, she's a midwife, and she has three other kids, and she really wants Jonah to go to college. But, you know, that's a tough sell when the alternative is just hanging out with your friends in LA and making Vine videos and getting paid a ton of money and going on tour. Mm.
And a lot of them have very lucrative sponsorship deals.
Yeah, they can get paid up to $100,000 for a sponsored Vine. So Vines are 6 seconds long. you can do the math on how much they're getting paid per second, but the more famous ones get paid a lot. Invisalign or Coca-Cola or Trident will pay them to do a sponsored Vine.
Well, one of the things that came across to me in this article is that it is representative of the decentralization of fame. You know, like anybody can be famous. So what does it mean? You know, we're in this world where any middle schooler, any preteen, any tween can create something of themselves online. In the one hand, it's fabulous. I mean, anybody can do it. It's the American dream. On the other hand, how much energy goes into trying to be internet famous for a kid?
I think a lot. I don't know what it's like for the ones who are just trying to be internet, you know, who are sort of on their way up. But the kids that I was with are spending all of their time doing this. It's a lot of work. And I had mixed feelings about watching that because, you know, I think there's no unfamous. You know, the youngest kid that was on tour was 14. He has 3.9 million Twitter followers. And he chose this. He, you know, he's very happy to be doing this, but you make a lot of choices when you're 14 that you regret later. You know, I dyed my hair blue when I was 14, and I'm really glad I don't still have blue hair. So it's very strange to watch, and they're very young. And one of the things about this decentralization of fame is that there are fewer kind of checks and balances. If anyone can be famous, there's no one telling you that maybe it's not a good idea to be famous, or at least that there are repercussions to being famous for the rest of your life. Like, nobody tells these kids, hey, if you keep doing this, you're going to need to contend with the fact that you can never go to a high school football game without being mobbed.
It is not just DigiTour that is making money out of this. There are management companies. There's a whole apparatus developing. From what you saw, Ellen, is this a growth industry representing and presenting the internet famous?
This is absolutely a growth industry. I think that we're going to see this just explode. I don't think I'm being hyperbolic at all. The wave is just cresting. A lot of the early social media celebrities are now making movies that are, you know, going into real movie theaters and releasing singles to varying degrees of success. But there's this huge, huge apparatus kind of being scrambled to be built up around them that I really just think is only going to grow.
So, Ellen, you softened up a bit on this. Are you a convert? Are you following anybody, any 14-year-olds on Vine?
I have to confess that I still am. You know, 6 seconds isn't all that long, and some of their videos are weirdly charming, but I'm pretty embarrassed to say that on the radio.
Ellen Cushing, a real pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much for introducing me, anyway, to this bizarre universe.
Thank you.
Ellen Cushing is a writer and article editor for BuzzFeed's tech section. That's where we found her article, Sexts, Hugs, and Rock and Roll. And you'll find a link to read it for yourself and see some of the fabulous pictures of DigiTour. It's all at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Well, you might have thought that things could not get any worse for the comedian Bill Cosby, but they did over the weekend. And despite growing evidence and charges leveled against him, most of his accusers have run out of time to press criminal charges. Up next, a lawyer explains the history and the reasons for why statutes of limitations exist in our legal system. That's after a short break when Word of Mouth continues. The level of public disgust at Bill Cosby hit a new low over the weekend. The New York Times released excerpts from a 2006 deposition Cosby gave after being accused of drugging and molesting a woman. In it, he admits to slipping drugs to young women with the intent of having sex with them. In addition, he was not above flaunting his fame or promising mentorship and professional guidance to those that he hoped to seduce. Even staunch defender Whoopi Goldberg publicly withdrew her support as the once adored comedian was increasingly being shown as a manipulative sexual predator. Cosby has been accused of rape and assault by nearly 50 women, and yet only one of these alleged assaults can still be prosecuted due to statute of limitation laws that prevent older cases from going to trial. David Ruoff is a trial attorney with Howard and Ruoff in Manchester, New Hampshire, and president-elect of the New Hampshire Bar Association. We asked him here to explain statute of limitation laws in general and to better understand the sexual assault and defamation cases now against Bill Cosby. And David, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me, Virginia.
So first of all, are statutes of limitation, is that a federal laws or are these state by state?
They're both, and they vary state by state significantly for criminal or civil cases and also in federal court as well.
Okay, so criminal cases cannot be brought against Bill Cosby, if I understand that, except for by one woman because of statutes of limitations.
For the most part, that's correct. It's very difficult to bring old charges. There have to be very unique exceptions to the statute of limitations, like New Hampshire has several that would apply to the Cosby case. But in the jurisdiction where he's been reviewed, they've already concluded that they could not because there's no exception to the statute of limitations for those crimes.
So what is the purpose of the statute of limitation laws in general?
Well, the statutes of limitations came about historically to prevent stale prosecutions. It's an old throwback to old England, where the king could file criminal charges against anybody at any given time, particularly if they became politically prominent or powerful. The court would impose indictments on them and take them out of the running to become politically powerful.
Uh-huh.
So that's why you have these statutes that were passed, like the statutes of frauds and statutes of limitations, to rein in the power of the king to knock out competition. So that's where they come from. Today, they're really just jurisdictional in nature, which means that they limit when police can file charges.
With the idea being that, you know, if a crime is so old, they cannot necessarily get the evidence or can't necessarily defend themselves?
It's more prophylactic than that. It's actually rooted in due process for the accused because it's very difficult to defend against allegations that are very, very old, very difficult to come up with, alibi witnesses or rebuild timelines to defend against a case.
Well, are statutes of limitation different depending on the crime? Say, is it different for theft than something like sexual assault?
Under New Hampshire law, the statute for like sexual assault or what we call felonious sexual assault, aggravated felonious sexual assault, there's a special rule for those types of cases that extends the statute of limitations for minor victims. Okay, so if you're under the age of 18 years old and you've been victimized, your statute of limitations for reporting and having that case prosecuted doesn't run until 22 years past your 18th birthday. So it gives people the ability to get out of a household or a relationship and gives them a sufficient amount of time to be able to deal with and go forward with a prosecution and assist. For garden variety offenses, it depends on the severity. For example, for misdemeanors, it's only a year. For violations, it's 90 days. So if you get stopped for speeding and they don't give you a ticket for 90 days, you are scot-free. But for most felonies, it's typically 6 years.
How about something like murder? We have the New Hampshire cold case unit now. How far back can they go?
Murder's one of the only crimes for which there is no statute of limitations.
Now, you have a lot of experience dealing with sexual assault cases that have passed or exceeded statutes of limitation. So what is it about those crimes specifically that might make this more than a common occurrence?
Well, the dynamics in those cases, specifically cases involving children that are victims of sexual violence, the dynamics between the offender and the victim are complex. And sometimes the victim doesn't even know that they're being victimized until they are pretty far removed from that relationship. All you have to do is look at the clergy cases, mm-hmm. where many kids were thought that, what was being done to them was appropriate and normal. And it wasn't only until decades passed where they realized that it wasn't. Okay. So those types of cases, have really created this exception to the what was historically just a six-year statute of limitations. Mm. And we're not going back too far. I mean, New Hampshire statute of limitations only changed in 1981. Prior to that, it was, you know, just a typical five-year statute of limitations.
I actually just read that Florida recently changed, doubled its statute of limitations for sexual assault cases. So is there a similar push to expand in other states?
I think as a result of the publicity of these cases, yes. That being said, you know, very old cases are very difficult to prosecute. Having done that a bunch in my career, I can tell you that when you look at a case that's very, very old, the chances of being able to put together proof beyond a reasonable doubt is pretty difficult.
Hmm. I'm speaking with David Roth. He's a trial lawyer and president-elect of the New Hampshire Bar Association. And we're speaking about statute of limitation laws, especially as they relate to the dozens of alleged sexual assaults committed by the comedian Bill Cosby, only one of which may go to trial. So if statutes of limitation have passed for a criminal case, do victims have any kind of recourse in civil court?
Yes, they do. And quite often, the civil statutes of limitations for those types of offenses are longer. For example, we'll use New Hampshire as an example. It's 22 years after a victim turns 18 years old. But that is for regardless of the victim's age. Okay, that exception for the criminal statute only applies to minor victims. So you have to be under 18 at the time for that 22-year extension to apply. For a civil case, that's not true. It can be any time for the 22 years after you turn 18.
So why is that for a civil case so much easier to establish a case?
Well, I think the reason that the civil statutes are longer is because the legislatures are less concerned about criminal due process violations in stale criminal prosecutions. Keep in mind that the convictions for these types of offenses carry very hefty sentences, typically, measured in decades. So I think the legislatures were more inclined to give leeway to people to sue civilly for damages. And a lot of times, that's what victims want. They want reparation. A lot of times, they don't want the drawn-out procedure that entails a criminal trial.
Well, given that the time has passed for filing criminal charges against Cosby for sexual assault, three of the Cosby's alleged victims have filed defamation cases against the former TV star. Now, what is their argument?
They are clever. What they did was they made public their accusations, and then they allowed Cosby and his camp to deny the allegations publicly. And they're claiming that by him denying it, that they are now defamed because he's publicly called them liars. And as private citizens, the protection of defamation law from state to state is much greater. Okay, so they can actually sustain a civil action against him for him publicly calling them liars.
So have you seen that kind of workaround being used before?
I think it's rare. I haven't seen it highlighted to the degree that it's been highlighted in the media with the Cosby case, Sue.
Do you think now that all these allegations against Cosby have a strong public momentum, especially after these documents were unsealed, will prosecutors be actively looking to pursue a criminal case?
Against him? If they have a way to get around a statute of limitations bar, they will. I mean, there are routinely cases. For example, in New Hampshire, the statute of limitations stops running if you are continuously absent from the jurisdiction. So if you commit an assault in New Hampshire and you leave and go to Massachusetts for 20 or 30 years, that statute of limitations doesn't run. I don't know if New Jersey or Massachusetts have those similar types of exceptions, but I know that prosecutors tend to like to make their judgments about going forward on a case on the merits and not just because of a technical jurisdictional limit by the statute.
Well, David Roth, thank you very much for explaining for us today.
Glad I could help.
David Roth, he's a trial attorney with Howard & Roth in Manchester, New Hampshire, and now president-elect of the New Hampshire Bar Association. You'll find more on the statute of limitations and the Cosby case at wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you so much for your listening time today. There is much more to hear and to explore at wordofmouthradio.org, including the Word of Mouth podcast. You can also sign up for it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes or wherever you find your podcasts. And if you like it, please write a review and pass it along and tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott, and we'll be back with more word of mouth tomorrow at 2 here on New Hampshire Public Radio.